This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A bit later in the program, we'll talk with the Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, Mark McClellan. But first, if you've been keeping track of the rash of forensic science shows on TV, chalk up another one this season. And this one is about cold cases. Is it a case of art imitating science again? Well, consider this. Each year, nearly 6,000 homicide cases go unsolved in this country, adding to the backlog of some 200,000 cases that have been piling up since 1960. For local police departments, unsolved cases eventually move to the back of the line as new cases take priority and tight budgets limit the resources needed to solve the cases. But a newly formed group at West Virginia University is committed to clearing some of these cold case files. The Institute for Cold Case Evaluation will provide forensic experts to local law enforcement free of charge. You get your own forensic expert to help your detectives figure out the whodunit. Let me introduce my guest. John Paul Jones is the business director for the newly formed Institute for Cold Case Evaluation, the ICCE, at West Virginia University. He joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Ira.
Why the sudden interest in solving cold cases?
Well, their cold cases have really existed for an extended period of time, and at this point, more and more media coverage is starting to bring these cases to the limelight. And we know my partner Max Hauck and I were thinking about ways that we could help out with the contacts that we have to help do something about these cold cases that have been held by law enforcement. And we thought the best thing that we could do would be to form a nonprofit group that would be able to at least assist law enforcement in investigating these crimes. So it's really gaining in popularity, the cold case units are, and more people are taking notice of it. And we thought that we would be able to help shed some more light on these cases and to help folks get some more solved.
Now, there are, 18,000 police departments world across the country?
Yes, that's accurate.
How many can your nonprofit help at any one time?
Boy, that's a good question. At this point, we're not focusing on the number of total law enforcement agencies that we can assist. We're starting to focus on the number of actual cases that we can handle. Now, if we tried to jump in and solve all 200,000 cases at one time, that's a bit of a big chunk of work to do, and I don't think there's enough forensic experts in the world to do that right this second. But what we're doing is we're hoping to start off at about 10 cases a month where we can provide expert assistance to cold case units and start off at that point and scale up our operations as the demand grows with us.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about cold cases with John Paul Jones. I promise no cracks about your name.
Yeah, I'm not related to the bass player of Led Zeppelin or the famous admiral in the Navy. So.
And we can't see your eyes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just already reneged on my promise.
That's right.
So it's not the TV series about cold cases that has brought this to fore. You did this before that the TV series came out.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's actually multiple shows on television that detail cold cases. I believe there's one on the A&E network and also the new cold case show that's airing, I believe it's this fall. And then you see shows like The New Detectives and other medical detective shows that talk about cases that they've solved, homicide cases. And sometimes they distinguish them as being cold cases or current cases. But forensics is becoming a lot more popular, and we're thinking that we might be able to really help with the publicity being shown, generate interest in what we're doing, and help us fund the analysis of these old cases.
Of course, on TV, they solve the whole thing in an hour.
Yeah, it would be nice if reality was like that, but that's not the way it works. But you know, the good thing about that, though, is the way they detail it on TV, it actually makes more young people interested in the science. And when they enter universities looking to study this, their hearts are usually broken when they find out that not everybody is very attractive in the crime laboratory, and it isn't like a TV set.
That's very interesting. Now, you have 200,000 cold cases. How are you going to choose which ones your experts, and they'll do this for nothing, basically, with the police departments, correct?
Yeah, I can explain real quickly how our model's going to work and then address the question about how we're going to select them. What we're going to do is we're going to have the cold case units submit a case file to our agency of what they have done so far. And we're going to take that case file and farm it out to several of our forensic experts to do an independent review on the case. And these experts are going to detail an action item list or a punch list that we can send back to the cold case unit on how they could advance this case through forensic means. And the way we're going to pay for this is we're going to solicit outside donations from corporations and other individuals that can help fund our experts' agreed-upon reduced rates. So not all of our experts are be doing this for free, but some of them will be receiving reduced rates that we will pay through outside donations.
So what kind of budget are you talking about that you need here to make this work?
Well, for the way we've looked at it so far is that we're hoping to be able to fund the review of a single case for about $1,500. And that would get us an action item list from up to three forensic experts. That's what our model is based on right now. And we have not started accepting cases because our agency just launched last week. And we're trying to generate demand and also set up some contracts with our forensic experts at this point. But that's what our model is based on.
And how do you choose which cases if these start flooding in here?
Yeah, sure. And we do plan on having them flood in. What we're going to do is we're going to try to select cases initially that have a high probability of solvability if they have forensic with forensic evidence. And what I mean by that is if you have your typical gang shooting where there was really like no biological evidence that that was deposited at the scene, or forensics may not play a huge part in that crime, we're probably not be less likely to take that case as compared to one where it was a homicide from like a stabbing from the late 80s where DNA was not real popular. It existed, but it was not real popular back then. And we believe that we may be able to make a difference with those kind of cases that have been just sitting for years waiting for some help.
And how much does this, the new DNA fingerprinting help you in solving some of these old cases?
Oh, extremely. It's a very important factor. I mean, if you look at it now, the FBI's convicted offender DNA index, the combined DNA indexing system that they have about 1.3 million convicted offender DNA profiles in there. And those are folks that are waiting to have their DNA profiles compared against crime scene samples. And if you don't actually match one of the folks in the DNA index, you may match another crime scene DNA profile, and there's 58,000 of those in the index. So there's all of this, all these profiles, DNA profiles out there waiting to help solve crimes. And if we can grab a case that's been on a dusty file cabinet for 20 years, dust it off and say, wow, there's some forensic DNA evidence or other type of evidence that we can be tested here, and that's all that needs to be done. I mean, that's great, and it can really help solve these crimes.
And if you just started out, as you say, just a few days ago,
yes.
When do you think you'll be up and running and starting your first cases? And how are you going to find those cases?
Sure. This past week, we attended the International Homicide Investigators Association meeting out in Las Vegas. And we had a lot of discussions with cold case detectives out there. And it was actually a meeting dedicated to cold cases, which is really great. And so we've started laying the foundation with receiving cases from these individuals. And over the next few weeks, we're going to start finalizing some of our contracts with our forensic experts. And so I would think within a month to two, we could start accepting cases, whether it's exactly 10 right when we start or not is a question, because we're going to be ramping up. But I would think in a month or two we could start really making a difference.
Well, good luck to you.
Well, thank you so much.
And we'll check back in to see how well you're doing.
Yeah, that's great. And if any of the listeners want to check out our website, it's www.coldcases.org.
And we're not talking beer here, right?
No, okay. We're not talking beer.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. John Paul Jones is a business director for the newly formed Institute for Cold Case Evaluation at West Virginia University. For the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about one of the largest federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration. You know it as the FDA. It is responsible for overseeing the safety of a surprising number of the products we consumers use, from the milk in your fridge to the vitamins on your kitchen counter to the medicines in your bathroom cabinet, even the pills you give to your dog. are regulated by the FDA, and the FDA has been very busy lately, from warning cities and states that it's illegal to buy drugs from Canada, to offering advice about taking hormone replacement therapy, to trying to speed up the process of bringing new drugs to the market, to looking out for counterfeit drugs, all the while with a mandate to protect the country's food supply from terrorists. And these are just some of their duties. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk with the person responsible for running this agency with a proposed 2004 budget of $1.7 billion. How do you think it's going? Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Your questions for the FDA commissioner, 1-800-989-8255. Let me formally introduce Mark McClellan. He is commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Ira, it's great to be on with you and your listeners.
What is your biggest task at the FDA presently?
There is no one specific task. You just went through a subset of all of our responsibilities. Our overall mission is to protect the health of the public, and that's a tougher mission than ever with our new challenges in the areas of terrorism, with a broader array of foods and medical products on the market and in development than ever before. And another important part of our mission is advancing the public health, helping people get better information so that they can take better care of themselves, get the most out of all the products that are on the market today and all of the scientific knowledge out there. And as you mentioned, to speed up the availability of even better new treatments and new foods.
There's so much to talk about. Let me go backwards with what you started with, your mission to help with counterterrorism. In what way are you mandated and are you working on that?
This affects both the food and the drug side of our agency. On the food side, there have been real threats. There were arrests earlier this year of terrorist cells in Europe that were working on a poison called ricin that can be used in the food supply. There have been reports of possible anthrax contamination and the like. We have new authorities and new resources to protect our country against imported foods that may be unsafe, to monitor the safety of the food supply throughout. This amounts not only to taking on a new responsibility to keep our food supply secure and protect us against what people might deliberately do to harm us, it also amounts to some of the biggest expansions in our food safety activities in decades. On the medical side of the agency, we are working hard to bring new treatments to the public that could be used in the event of a terrorist attack, radiologic, nuclear, biological. The country is better prepared than it ever has been, but there is more that we think needs to be done. For example, we've got enough smallpox vaccine available that if there were an attack, we could make it available to everyone in the country. But it's a vaccine based on technology developed in the 1790s. It's not one based on some of the latest recombinant DNA techniques like you were just talking about earlier in the show that have the potential for being even safer and more effective.
We only have about a minute to go to the break, but you also have, it says here that you're going to be registering the country's 400,000 food manufacturers, processors, and packing companies.
We have new regulations going into effect at the end of this year that will make it possible for us to let food manufacturers or distributors know if there is any kind of foodborne illness outbreak, terrorist or otherwise, in origin. This will help us implement our food safety mission much more effectively.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Mark McClellan, who's commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We'll talk about lots of issues of the day, and I bet you must be swamped with stuff.
We're definitely staying busy down here in Washington.
Okay, we'll take a short break and take lots of your calls and a lot of issues to talk about. The ads on TV you see for drugs, how do we bring these new drugs to the market safely and make sure that they're not rushed into production. And we'll take your questions, so stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with the Commissioner, Mark B. McClellan, Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And Dr. McClellan, you bring a very interesting background to this job. You're an MD and you're also an economist. Two degrees gotten at the same time, I understand?
Well, pretty much at the same time. I've gotten a lot of help along the way with getting where I am.
Well, I hope you paid off those college loans. No, you probably had scholarships.
That's
right. You're as smart as you are. Let's talk about drugs. This is a big issue. People going to Canada to buy drugs. And you recently warned I don't know if warning is the right word. You informed the state of California that they were breaking the law, and other states and municipalities, that they were breaking the law in ordering drugs from Canada. Are Canadian drugs so much worse than our drugs?
Canada, just like the United States, has a very effective system for assuring the safety and the effectiveness of drugs that people buy in pharmacies in Canada. If you walk into a pharmacy in Canada, just like if you walk into one in the United States, you can be very sure that you're going to get a drug that is safe and that works as it's intended to work. Where all bets are off is when people go outside of these regulated systems and buy over long distance from sources on the internet and the like. Those sources aren't regulated by us. They're outside this country. The Canadian government has said that they can't assure the safety of drugs exported to the United States. That's outside their area of jurisdiction, too. And I don't think we should settle for a buyer beware market for getting affordable pharmaceuticals. I think we can do better than that.
But give us an example of the problems that have been created, examples of bad drugs coming in from Canada through these organizations.
Well, there's all kinds of examples. Sometimes these drugs are shipped, again, over long distances improperly. For example, we've seen cases where drugs that need to be refrigerated to be stored properly, like insulin, are shipped at room temperature in regular mail, so they may not work as intended when they get to the patient. We've seen drugs shipped without proper warnings, without proper risk management procedure. A lot of the medications on the market today can do a lot of good, but they need to be monitored carefully so that people don't have the side effects that can go along with them. Mm-hmm. We've seen expired drugs shipped, and we've seen problems with counterfeit drugs, adulterated drugs that unscrupulous providers try to get into the game, because that's where the money is when they see an opening in the regulatory system.
But I can go across the country and get the same problems without shipping it from Canada. I can, you know, go on the internet and ship it from Wyoming, let's say, and not be assured that any of that stuff is...
That's right. Well, there are definitely some worthy sites on the internet I don't know if there are any in Wyoming, but there definitely are
sorry,
some that are regulated by boards of pharmacy in the United States and that follow our prescriptions for providing drugs accurately and safely. And if you go to our website at FDA.gov, we can give you some tips on finding those websites. I think it is important, though, to buy within a system where you're not on your own, where you're not in the Wild West, to make sure you're getting drugs that are safe and effective.
So if you were driving up to Canada, though, and you were taking a shipload of or a U-Haul full of drugs back to your HMO or whatever you are, that would be okay because you're buying them in Canada.
Well, you buy them in Canada, but if you put them on that U-Haul where the conditions could be hot, where the drugs might not be stored properly, where they don't come along with the proper manufacturer warnings and systems for notifying pharmacies, doctors, and the FDA if there's a problem, you do take some risks.
Mm-hmm. Why are drugs so much cheaper in Canada than they're here?
Canada has a system for regulating drug prices, and that doesn't happen for people in the United States who don't have drug coverage. In the United States, people can get lower prices for drugs than those that are available if you just walk in off the street to a pharmacy through their insurance plan. There's some government insurance plans that get much lower prices. There's some private insurance plans that get much lower prices. But for people who don't have good coverage, and that includes millions of seniors today, they're paying literally the highest prices in the world, and that's something that people in this country are appropriately angry about. That's just not right.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about drug advertising on TV, because this is some of the stuff that bothers me the most. Usually it happens on the evening news. I'm sure you all are all aware of it. An ad will come up for a drug that we don't even know what it's for. It's go ask your doctor about this drug. I mean, if people approached you on the street and asked you if you wanted to buy some drugs, we'd call them pushers. But, you know, how is that different from people on TV asking you to buy them drugs, except they're called drug companies?
Well, Americans get hit with advertisements every day for all kinds of products that they may or may not need. We do monitor the advertisements that come on the air for drugs and make sure that they're not presented in a misleading way. And you're right that within the law, under the First Amendment, companies can put something on the air that says, ask your doctor about blank. There have been a lot of studies, though, done that look at the effects of prescription drug advertising, and while there are some problems, and I'd be happy to talk about those, they do have one important benefit, which is they get people into the doctor for conditions that are undertreated in this country, conditions that previously have been stigmatized in this country, like depression, or think about how public views about erectile dysfunction have changed in the last few years. These are conditions that previously were undertreated, where there are good treatments available now that can make people's lives better and longer, and so there's there's an upside to advertising, and we need to try to get the advantages of that while taking care of the potential downsides.
Do you work at all with the FTC that regulates the advertising?
We work very closely with the FTC. We have responsibility over prescription drug advertising. They have responsibility over advertising for food products and dietary supplements that often make health claims. And we have the same goal in mind, which is making sure that the ads are accurate and they give people a truthful and non-misleading presentation of what the product can do for their health. This is very important today because there's so many things that people can do to improve their health. We want to make sure there's accurate information out there, and the companies that get rewarded are the ones that provide the best quality products.
What about drug labeling and the label inserts that are supposed to be put out by drug companies that have not shown up yet?
There are drug label inserts that are available for both physicians and patients, and we are doing more than ever to try to get those out. The latest statistics, I think, show that just about always patients get an insert when they buy a prescription, but the information contained in that insert isn't always as complete and accurate as we'd like. So we're going to try to provide some clear guidance about what ought to go in there. And as we head more into an electronic era in medical prescribing, our goal is that very soon, within just a few years, hopefully extremely soon, if we get this Medicare drug benefit passed, because it includes provisions along these lines, we will be able to provide electronically the latest information from the FDA about what a patient needs to know on the risks and benefits of a drug, and we'll be able to do that electronically very soon.
So you're expecting the 75-year-olds to be computer literate and download with the
Medicare
benefit?
No, they don't need to download it.
To look what they online?
Right. There are a surprising number of 75-year-olds that do go online and find out what the right drug is for them, and there's more information available to them than ever before, and we want to help make sure that's accurate. But even for those that don't, their pharmacy is increasingly connected to a health information infrastructure that can get access to the latest information to help those patients use the drug effectively. If the pharmacy's connected, we can send them the latest information on the risk and benefits of a drug, get that printed out in nice, large, clear, easy-to-read print and easily understandable directions for a patient to use. That's our goal of using information technology more effectively.
Oh, so they would print it out right there at the pharmacy?
Hand it to them. The technology would operate behind the scenes, but the goal is higher quality care.
All this is if we get a Medicare bill that covers...
Well, it would be helped by a Medicare bill. Like, it's one of our top commitments at FDA to use modern technologies, and there are a lot of good technologies out there to help prevent errors and complications involving the products we regulate. The Medicare legislation includes some provisions for electronic prescribing, so-called e-prescribing, that would make it much easier for seniors to get the right drug at the right time and avoid prescribing errors, drug interaction problems, as well as help make sure they're getting accurate information about the treatments.
Mm-hmm. Before I go to the phones, one other question going back to the counterterrorism efforts. How much money are you getting additional to work on the counterterrorism?
The FDA has gotten a large amount of additional funding in the hundreds of millions of dollars each year for the past 2 years to get more people out in the field to help protect the country. And we've acted quickly on those additional funds. We've got more than 650 new field officers out there working at the borders, inspecting facilities, following up on potential concerns to help make sure the food supply is safe and secure. And this helps not only with terrorist threats, but also in preventing and containing foodborne illness outbreaks.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Jeff in St. Louis. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I think everybody knows that the statistics shows that America seems to be getting bigger and fatter, and I've recently heard on NPR that even our pets are getting bigger and fatter. And I'm wondering if there's been any independent studies on whether or not growth hormones that have been going into feed and so forth are actually getting into our systems as well. And I know that the industry has been pretty much responsible for doing all the testing up until now. I was wondering if there's any independent studies going on and what those might show. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, that's a very good question. There are various types of hormones and other products used in agricultural production, and much of this is regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, not us. There are actually a few things the FDA doesn't regulate, and they make sure that the hormones are used in a way that presents no safety threats, and they are monitoring the science there as well, as are we. We work very closely with them in many areas to make sure we keep up to date with what the latest science has to say about whether we're doing everything we can to keep the food supply safe.
Of course, when the Department of Agriculture was created, and it's one of the oldest places in the country, all those organizations here in the government, it was way before there were growth hormones and antibiotics and things like that being put in the feed. Don't you think now that we eat all this stuff, it should be switched over to your bailiwick, or you don't want that hot potato?
Well, I think the main goal is that we're working together and that Americans can have assurances that the foods they eat are safe. Whether we do it or USDA does it, the main goal is that we're accomplishing our mission. We've been around for a while, too, Ira. The FDA is about to celebrate its centennial. We were formed in 1906, and, you know, you talk about a change in mission. Back then, one of our main roles was going after, literally, snake oil salesmen, and now there are still modern versions of that available, but with the whole spectrum of better medicines and foods that can influence your health and so many other things, our mission at the FDA is the same as it was back then. Keep the food supply safe, keep the drugs safe, help people improve their health. But what we do has changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. And that's true at USDA as well.
But you're in charge of putting the labels on the food. But we don't, right?
We are in charge of food labeling, and in particular, we're the ones that get the nutrition labels on, which help people identify what exactly they're eating. And we also regulate any claims that foods might make about their consequences for your health. And I want to see more food competition around health. As as Jeff mentioned on his call earlier, there is a real public health threat from the growing problem of obesity and overweight, and there's a lot of things that people can do through their dietary choices to prevent illnesses. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that the foods on the market today are doing as much as they can to help them live healthier lives.
Then saying all of that, you should be very much in favor of having labels on our meat that would tell us what kind of hormones are in them so we can make those choices.
The main focus for us at FDA is not on meat, but our mission in getting information on a product label is making sure consumers know what they need to know about the possible health consequences of that food. Where the science suggests there should be information on a label that has health consequences for people, we'll try to get it there.
And we have milk that has the hormones in them also. That's your bailiwick, isn't it?
Well, all biological products have, all products from animals often have some kinds of at least trace levels of hormones. These occur naturally as well, and we do regulate any claims made about those products to make sure that they are portraying accurately what's in them and what's not. I think every milk on the market, even those grown without those from cows that were not treated with supplemental hormones, do contain naturally occurring hormones too, and we want to make sure that they're in a level that doesn't present any health threats.
Talking about food this hour with FDA Commissioner Mark McClellan on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So then you do monitor the levels of hormones in milk and make sure that they're not high enough, or do we not know what the high enough levels would be?
We do have a lot of scientific evidence on what levels of various food additives and food elements might present safety threats. In fact, a big part of our mission at FDA is what we call risk analysis and risk management, and that involves gathering the scientific evidence on what risks may be facing the public and the data on what the levels of various elements and components in foods might be, and then to implement steps to reduce risk where we do think there are concerns present.
1-800-989-8255. Peter in Boston. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I'd like to ask the commissioner, since in particular he has a background also in economics, we hear how much it costs to bring a new drug to market these days, whether it's tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. But I haven't gotten a good sense for how much our government is spending, either directly to perhaps to drug companies for their research and testing, or indirectly to universities for more basic sciences. How much taxpayer money is going into new drug development in the United States, and how does this compare with what other countries may be spending?
Very good question, Peter. The answer is a lot more than ever before. Today, the U.S. government is spending about $27 billion on health research through the National Institutes of Health and a few billion more through other programs. In addition to that, the pharmaceutical industry in the United States is spending over $30 billion on research and development, and medical device manufacturers, which are increasingly involved in drug development too, through novel drug delivery systems, are spending billions more. And then there's the whole new and growing biotech industry that is putting billions into research and development. And these numbers in the United States are far larger than the numbers in the rest of the world combined. The U.S. is the world leader in medical technology development, and that's a kind of a public-private partnership. The government funds a lot of the basic research and gets some very good ideas up to the stage where they can potentially become valuable treatments in people. And then product developers, biotech companies, pharmaceutical companies, and the like conduct further testing and then go through all the steps on developing manufacturing procedures to make sure the drugs can be produced safely and effectively mm-hmm. and used reliably in people.
They don't pay back the government for that money, do they?
They don't pay back the government for the basic research. They do incur additional costs in bringing the products through the clinical testing process. You know, we don't allow a product to be marketed in the United States, a drug or a biological, unless it's shown to be safe and effective and unless we're confident that it's manufactured according to techniques and it's got labeling that meets our standards as well. So all of those steps need to be addressed before a product gets to market in the United States.
Okay, does that answer your question, Peter? Right, he's gone. So then they just put that as the cost of doing business, and you think if you're paying $5 or $10 a pill, maybe the government should get us $90 or $100 million back.
Well, the government's certainly putting a lot into it, and the drug companies and product developers are as well. I think some of the latest estimates, and Peter mentioned this, are that a new drug might cost $800 million to bring to market, and there's some controversy around that. But one thing that I think is uncontroversial is that the cost of developing a new medical treatment has gone way up, by all estimates, more than doubling in the last decade. Right. And this is a real concern in an era when, on the one hand, we got more treatments available than ever before to treat more conditions than ever before, but on the other hand, healthcare affordability is a real problem.
All right, we'll talk more about that when we come back, talking with Mark McClellan of the FDA. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with the Commissioner of Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Mark McClellan, our number 1-800-989-8255. Before the break, you were touching on how do we make drugs cheaper to
right.
bring to market. I would imagine that would mean speeding up this whole process. But then how do we ensure that they're still safe if we're going to speed them up?
Good question. Speeding up is part of it, but being smarter in our drug development process is, I think, the best way to get there. We don't want to compromise our standards for safety and effectiveness, but there are a lot of good ideas out there for how we can make the process work better so we keep safe and effective drugs getting to market, but we reduce the uncertainty and reduce the time. For example, we're doing a lot of work now on some of the new technologies that are just starting to have an impact on drug development. Some of the DNA techniques that are part of genomics, the science of proteomics, there are all kinds of new information and decision sciences that can be brought to bear on efficient drug development, as well as new nanotechnologies, very small, essentially devices that can get the drugs to the right place without causing toxicities. Well, this is a new way of developing products, and it's one reason that it's so expensive to develop new drugs today. If we can use our expertise and the latest science to help product developers understand what works and what doesn't in solving all of the many practical problems of getting a drug to market, we can help reduce the cost and the time of getting safe and effective treatments to people.
What usually the cost and time is many years worth of three different kinds of trials involving thousands mm-hmm. of people.
That's right.
Is there not the danger that by cutting down on the number of people, let's say, over the number of years, that these problems are going to show up later once the people are taking the drugs?
Well, you don't necessarily have to cut down on the number of trials. You just need to get smarter on designing those trials. So, for example, more than half of the products that get to the most expensive part of the development process, the third phase of the trials, more than half of those actually fail and don't end up resulting in applications to us. If we can do a better job through understanding the genetics of how a drug would work in an individual patient or whether it might have side effects, we can design those trials better in people where they really are likely to have, where the product really is likely to have a beneficial effect. And all of that money will not be wasted, and potentially the trial can be completed more quickly.
And that is a cutting edge, trying to find genetically which people would benefit from which drug the most by the genetic
makeup.
That's right.
And so that's exactly right.
Yeah, so you then, I understand what you're saying. 1-800-999-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Anne Marie in Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, Anne Marie.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I want to begin by thanking the commissioner for overseeing all of the food labeling that's been going on. I have a little girl who has several life-threatening food allergies, and it would be impossible for us to grocery shop without those labels. The one thing, though, that continues to be a problem for us, one of her allergies is dairy. She truly will die if she eats dairy, so her throat will close up. Many products continue to use an ingredient called casein, which I understand to be a direct derivative of dairy, in their products, and yet they're allowed to continue to call it a non-dairy product and to label it on the front of it. So we know several people where well-meaning relatives have given a child, like my daughter, a non-dairy product and had them go into anaphylactic shock because they didn't realize that casein was actually a dairy product. Why is that, and can it be changed, and what's holding it up?
That's a very good question, Anne Marie. The ingredient casein does have to be listed on the ingredient list if it's present, but you're right that people might look on the front of the package and see non-dairy. One of the things that we're working on right now with a lot of members of Congress is whether we can get clearer allergy labeling onto food products that would cover cases where substances like this, dairy-derived substances, which are one of the common kinds of allergies, would be listed more prominently and clearly on the front of a package. In the meantime, there is some work that consumers have to do. They do need to read the food labels carefully, and we're trying to do better than that, though.
So you don't have the power then to just say, we need this label, this package?
The labeling on a package is what we can put on, what we can require to be put on a package is determined by what our statutory authorities are, and I would like to see us have a little bit more statutory authority related to allergy labeling.
Then how can they put non-dairy in bold print on the front of a product and yet have a dairy ingredient listed on the back?
The non-dairy standards are actually set by the Department of Agriculture, not by us, since they regulate a lot of the dairy products.
That's strike two. That's strike two, Commissioner.
that is something I'll try to get addressed.
the politics of this, Anne Marie, it would make your hair hurt. It would make your hair hurt to understand the politics of the Agriculture Department and Congress and the lobbying and whatever that goes on there. I have to agree with you. You're absolutely right. And it should be as simple, and, you know, I don't understand why the FDA, I understand, I hear the answers, but I don't understand why the FDA just can't say, we've got to stop putting all these people in jeopardy. Let's get a label on there.
In the meantime, we are going to make sure that ingredients like casein are listed on the ingredient list, which is on the back of the package. It's not as easy to see as the front, but it is there. And parents like you who have kids with serious allergies need to be vigilant, and we'll try to help give you as much information as we can to make the right decisions for your kids.
Well, if you can get casein put on there, you should be able to get dairy or non-dairy.
Take that one back.
Okay.
Ira.
Well, okay. See, Anne Marie, you've changed history.
Well, you know, I have to say, though, it is very frustrating. We belong to a number
yeah.
of advocacy groups that we spend a lot of money that could go towards research trying to negotiate our way through the FDA, through the USDA, through the Department of Agriculture. And it's a huge waste of financial and personal resources that should be going in another area for something as simple as just labeling.
Write your congressman.
We already have.
Yeah, all of them. I mean, maybe it's, it's an election year coming up. Maybe this is a good time to.
Well,
everybody listening to write.
And we'll keep working on this.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see what other trouble we can get you into. Let's go to Grant in Kansas City. Hi, Grant.
Hi, how are you all doing today?
Fine, go ahead.
Great. I see if I can get them in trouble again. But what is your view on the labeling of herbal supplements? I feel like those are have pharmacological properties and could have some serious side effects, yet they aren't very well regulated. And I'd just be interested to hear your comments and what's being done about that. And I'll listen off
Grant,
the air.
Thank you.
Grant, good question. Dietary supplements are regulated differently than drugs. They're regulated more like foods. We have to prove that one is unsafe to take it off the market. It doesn't have to go through this pre-market process that Ira and I were just talking about to prove that it's safe and effective. There have also been some big problems with dietary supplements not being labeled accurately by having ingredients that aren't in the amount that's listed on the label or having ingredients in the product that's not even listed on the label at all. And we did take a big step to do something about that earlier this year. The FDA proposed a major new regulation that will apply to every dietary supplement in this country for accurate labeling to make sure that what's on the label is what's in the product, and good manufacturing practices to make sure that there aren't impurities contained in the product through bad manufacturing choices that could present health hazards. That hasn't taken effect yet, but I intend to clean this up so that it's not so much of a buyer beware market.
Does that also include advertising on TV?
The advertising of dietary supplements on TV is something that the FTC regulates, but we have a joint task force in place now that has implemented, I think, more and more effective enforcement of the law on dietary supplements making misleading claims than ever before. We have taken more joint actions this year on such products as dietary supplements claiming that they could cure SARS or cure many other diseases, and that includes seizing products, it includes getting manufacturers to stop making claims, and it includes taking further actions, including collecting financial penalties for the really bad actors. We need to clean that up, and we're doing more than we ever have before.
New York State has banned the sale of ephedra. Consumer unionists urge FDA to do the same. Is the FDA going to ban ephedra?
The New York State, I'm not sure if it was New York State, but they have passed some legislation in parts of New York that have the effect of banning ephedra. At the FDA, we can't just pass legislation to get our job done. We have to operate within the authorities that Congress gives us. And what they told us for ephedra, like other dietary supplements, is that we've got to prove that it's unsafe. The burden's on us. We can't compel that studies be done. We can't compel that manufacturers even give us information on adverse events. But we are trying to do the best we can on ephedra. Earlier this year, we sent out warning letters that got off the market all the ephedra products that were claiming that they improve sports performance. Why? Because there's no scientific evidence that's compelling that they do. And right now, we're in the midst of a regulatory process that has involved the collection and the analysis of all the information that's out there on the safety of ephedra. And we will be having more to say about this soon.
Mm-hmm. Talking with FDA Commissioner Mark McClellan this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We noticed, so we talk a lot about a very, very confusing issue that I noticed that the FDA has taken up, and that is on this past year in hormone replacement therapy for women. And I noticed that you now have a new website and a campaign to help women decide whether to use hormone therapy. Tell us about that.
That's right. We have a large women's health program at FDA, and one of its missions is to make sure that people are getting accurate information, up-to-date information, about how they should use products that affect their health. And one of the products that's very important to many women today is menopausal hormones. These are treatments that have some important proven benefits for hot flashes, night sweats, dryness, the symptoms of menopause, but that also, according to the latest scientific studies, carry some risks. And the point of this campaign is to get accurate information out so that women can make an informed decision based on a balanced presentation of all the facts about what hormone therapy, if any, is right for them.
Shouldn't they just be asking their doctors?
They should be asking their doctors, but they should go into their doctor's office armed with knowledge about what the right questions to ask are, armed with a good understanding of what the latest facts are. And the latest facts suggest that for many women, hormone therapy may be beneficial, but they should try to use the lowest dose and for the least amount of time that provides the relief that they need. Getting this kind of information out to the public so that they can have informed and useful conversations with their doctors, and so there's not a lot of confusion around issues like hormone therapy and what the latest scientific studies say. This is one of the key parts of our mission at FDA.
There are cynics out there, and there are many among us, who would say that this is an attempt by the hormone drug companies, who have been suffering sales of hormones to women, to get women back on hormones, using through your good auspices of getting people to ask their doctors about it, much like they'd say on television, ask your doctor.
Yeah, this is a campaign, though, that's a joint effort between us and some other government organizations and a lot of patient groups outside the government to get the word out in English and Spanish as effectively and clearly as we can. And it's about the scientific facts, and that's really what we're about at FDA. There are lots of people who have strong views on both sides or the 10 sides of the issues that we deal with. Our job is to try to sort through that and get the right facts to the public.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. It's been—I know you've been very busy, and we're going to check in with you periodically. Is that all right? See how things are going.
Ira, it's been a real pleasure, and I'll try to keep giving you plenty of material to work with.
Well, there's so much going on out there that it's not very hard to find that material.
No, that's right. This is a great time to be working on healthcare issues. I mean, there's so much happening and so many difficult challenges. It's a great time to be in Washington and trying to make.
So
a
you
difference.
Never regretted taking this job, then?
I don't, and I really enjoy opportunities like this to hear what people are thinking. It really does help us focus our efforts as effectively as possible. There's so much out there to do. We need help from the public in guiding us as to where we ought to be spending our efforts.
Well, you had a frank exchange of views today, I think, with some of our
sure
listeners,
did.
So we'll see what happens.
I'll look forward to another one.
Thanks a lot. Dr. Mark McClellan is the Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, and he joins us from our studios in Washington. Earlier, we spoke to John Paul Jones, Business Director for the newly formed Institute for Cold Case Evaluation at West Virginia University. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer and our director. Our intern is Annalise Strachan. And if you'd like to write us, or if you missed any of the references we make, you missed some of the links we talk about, no problem. Surf over to sciencefriday.com. Charles has them up there for you. We also have back editions of Science Friday. You can listen to them in real audio. You can take them with you on your audible.com player. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. And all the material we do on Science Friday, we turn into educational material. So you can bring them into school. The curricula is made for you to use with teachers and students. It's all up there at Kids Connection for your usage. I'm Ira Flato in New York.